This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 1 Samuel. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 8 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
1 Samuel chapter 8. Of all people, we Americans should understand that it was not a good idea for Israel to appoint a king. For America was born out of an outrage over the King of England's abuse of power. Author Walt Whitman sums up our country's origins. For many a promise sworn by royal lips and broken and laughed at in the breaking, the blows struck revenge. Heads of the nobles fell. People scorned the ferocity of kings. People do eventually scorn the ferocity of kings. Israel, though, wanted to be like their neighboring nations. They wanted a king and all that comes with one, a throne and a crown and a scepter and a court and a coronation and the pomp and circumstance. Rather than have faith in the invisible God, the Hebrews wanted a visible ruler on which they could fix their aspirations and their hopes. On the field of battle, while facing the enemy, the Israelis assumed that it would be easier to rally around a leader they could see than to rally around their God. From the outset, God wanted to be Israel's king. His ideal form of government was that of a theocracy, not a monarchy. But Israel ignored God's warning about the ferocity of kings and persisted in the demand for a king with clay feet. Finally, God gave in and gave them a king that they would regret again and again and again. Chapter 8 begins. Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. What happened to Eli befell Samuel. His sons became sleazeballs. They were supposed to be judges, but they acted more like crooks. They ended up subverting justice rather than upholding it. Why this happened, we're not told. We are told what happened to Eli. It was said of Eli that his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. Eli failed to discipline his sons. What Samuel's problem was, we're not sure, but it could be that he neglected his sons. For you remember, at the end of chapter 7, we're told that Samuel was a circuit preacher. You remember that? That his ministry looped among four different cities. Apparently, travel was a part of his job. It could be that Samuel didn't spend as much time with his sons as was necessary. I love this quote by Wade Horn. He says, "My father was a great dad. I didn't always think so, of course. When I was growing up, I mostly thought of him as an overbearing, autocratic, stick-in-the-mud whose main mission in life was to make mine miserable. But I have since come to realize that he had one great quality. He was there. Someone once said 90% of life was just showing up. My dad showed up. I look back on the good I've done for my kids, and I now realize that my greatest impact was not my father knows best wisdom, or my cleverness, or my coolness, or my coaching ability. The greatest service I've done my kids is that I've stayed in the mix. I've just been there. I've been involved. I've loved them so much, I've always said if my kids grow up to be nutcases, it's going to be because they spent too much time with me. I just wanted to be there. This is the greatest service a father can do his kids. Stay in the mix. Don't make the mistake, Dad, of thinking that your kids come with a pause button. They don't. Don't think you can just push pause, go off, do your own thing, then return and re-hit the button. Pick up where you left off. It doesn't work that way. Never forget, kids spell love T-I-M-E. Now that's assuming that Samuel made any mistakes at all. Why is it we always jump to the conclusion that just because a child ends up a rotten apple, it must mean that the parents have done a horrible job? Why is that? Hey, apply that logic, and then what are you going to say about God? God was the perfect parent, and yet Adam and Eve were still rebellious against Him. Understand, every human being, your child included, is a free moral agent. He or she has the right to choose which team they're going to play on. Holiness isn't hereditary. Godliness isn't genetic. Parents can provide their kids a great start, but it's up to the child to make the right choices. Well, why it happened, we're not sure, but Samuel's sons ended up more like crooks than judges, and they became Israel's excuse to demand a king. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." In other words, you're going to die off, and we don't like what we're going to get after you. "Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Understand, Samuel's sons were just an excuse. Israel's desire for a king really had predated Samuel. You remember back in the book of Judges, they wanted to crown Gideon. Their real motive is in verse 5. "Make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Famous Bible commentator G. Campbell Morgan, he calls this the supreme wrong. He writes, "Israel had been chosen to be unlike the nations, a people directly governed by God." The word Israel, in fact, means governed by God. God called Israel to be holy, to be set apart, to march to a different drummer. They were to keep in cadence with God's will and wisdom. Instead, the Hebrews muttered a familiar refrain that every parent has heard a million times: "Everybody else is doing it. Why can't I?" Verse 6 says, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord," and God reveals to Samuel Israel's root problem. "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." What sad words to fall from God's lips. The people's request for a king had nothing to do with Samuel or his sons. Apparently, trust and obey was just too straightforward. You see, a monarchy provided more options. You can hide stuff from a visible king who can't read your mind and heart. Oh, a king's judgments can be debated and amended. God's laws are absolute. A king and his court can be manipulated politically. Favors can be gained. Oh, God is just. Israel wanted a system to follow rather than developing a relationship with God. So the people swapped trust and obey for a chain of command and the play of politics and the rights of succession. They rejected God for human government. In verse 8, Samuel is told that the nation is now treating him in the same manner they've treated God. "According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day," the Lord says, "with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them that the behavior of the king who will reign over them." God is going to comply with their request, but not before he warns them about the ferocity of kings. Israel's going to get their monarchy, but here's what they have to look forward to. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over the thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipments for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. Understand, the evil of big government is about to invade Israel. You know, while God was king, government was simple and streamlined. Oh, God might appoint a judge every now and then, but generally speaking, God was enough. But with the form, this form of human government, expect bureaucracy and lots of it. For instead of the king serving the citizens, what ends up happening in human government is citizens are needed to serve the king. And that's not all. God doesn't need to eat, nor pay the rent, or entertain foreign heads of state. He's God. Or back up his supporters for their political support, or pay back his campaign contributors. God doesn't have to do anything of that like that. The ferocity of kings, though, includes taxes. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants, and build Gwinnett County parks. And what are these things they're doing now? These little walkabout little areas, you know, that they're building, whatever. And he will take a tenth of your grain in your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants. The king you crave is going to become your ball and chain. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the king will not hear you in that day, and you will cry out in that day. Hey, before you know it, Israel will want to throw tea in the harbor, trust me. Before you know it, they're going to have to live with a king. And as the old saying goes, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. History records the reign of very few benevolent dictators, very few kind kings. It's difficult for even a good man, you see, to handle power and authority afforded a king. And over the next 500 years, of the 42 kings who will rule over both the northern and southern Hebrew kingdoms, only 9 of those 42 are going to earn a positive approval rating from God. Remember Israel's mistake. The nation wanted to be like all the other nations. Peer pressure was Israel's downfall. The Israelis wanted to be like the Joneses. That was their mistake. Hey, as I tell my kids, just because your friends want to stick their head in the oven and bake their brains doesn't mean you have to do the same. No way. If God forbids it, there's a good reason it's forbidden. Israel is going to have to learn their lessons the hard way. Guys, God doesn't want us to go with the flow of this world. He wants our lives to draw a contrast. We're to be governed by God, not winging it on our own. God wants us to rise up and be different. God wants you to be loyal to the covenant you've made with Him, to be different in your approach to life. We need the gumption to stand up and stick out for Jesus. Following God is trusting that His way is best, even, listen to me, even when you're the only one in the room who thinks so. But Israel rejects the faithfulness of God and chooses the ferocity of kings, verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. Chapter 9 begins. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becheroth, the son of Ephiah, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. This Kish was a wealthy landowner, and he was a man of clout in Israel. And he had a choice and handsome son, whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. Not a more handsome guy in all of Israel than Saul. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Scan the crowd, and you could always spot Saul. He was always head and shoulders above everybody else. He was a head topper. If NBA basketball had been around in Saul's day, this guy would have made millions. And then after his career, he could have parlayed his stardom into a movie career because he was choice and handsome. In fact, we're told there was not a more handsome person among all the children of Israel than Saul. Here's a man who was literally tall, dark, and handsome. Imagine this man with leading man's looks, with an NBA center's height. My, oh my, here's a hunk that can dunk. And he did end up playing, I guess. I guess if he had been playing in the NBA, you know what team he would have played for, don't you? Not the Hawks. You know what team he would have played for if he'd have played in the NBA? You know that, don't you? The Kings. The Kings, yeah. You know, I was working on this on the way over here tonight. If Delilah played in the NBA, you know what team she would have played for? The Clippers. That's right, yeah. How about Balaam? What team would Balaam have played for? The Wizards. Nicodemus, it's easy. Nicodemus would have played for the Knicks. Nicodemus would have played for the Knicks. John the Baptist would have played for the Grizzlies. Oh, grizzly looking guy. And since Peter and John were fishermen, you know what team they would have played for. The Nets. That's right. Well, I tried. Verse 3. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, please take one of the servants with you and arise and go and look for the donkeys. Kish sends Saul out on a roundup to corral some lost donkeys. And so he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. Saul and his servants, they canvassed a whole countryside. Their journey probably accumulated about 100 miles in frequent flyer miles here. But no matter the 100 miles, they still ended up with no donkeys. When they had come to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us. Notice Saul is willing to stop short of the father's will and give up. This is going to be a reoccurring tendency in this man's life. Well, the servant said to him, look now, there is in this city a man of God, city of Zuph, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. Let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go. I mean, this guy's hooked up with God. Maybe we can find out from him where the donkeys are. Maybe God will reveal it. Then Saul said to his servant, but look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? And we got to give him a love offering. A man of God certainly would never charge for his services, but it would be appropriate to thank him in some way. What do we have for a love offering? For the bread in our vessels is all gone. Our canteens are empty. And there is no present to bring the man to the man of God. What do we have? And the servant answered Saul again and said, look, I have here at hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way. And then a footnote's added. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, come, let us go to the seer. For he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. A seer was a mystic. He was a person who could see into the spiritual realm. God would give him glimpses into the world of angels and into the supernatural. Now then Saul said to his servants, "Well said, come, let us go." And so they went to the city where the man of God was. And as they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" And if you're into puns, they could have said, "Can we see the seer?" Anyway, Saul bumps into this group of girls. Notice some young women. And there is a Jewish legend that suggests that the women wanted to talk to Saul. Why? Because he was so handsome. Well, apparently the girls sort of slow Saul down. Girls have slowed a lot of men down. But that's another story. And he needs to be sped up here a little bit. And so verse 12, "And they answered them and said, 'Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to this city, because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. As soon as you come into the city, you shall surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore, go up, for about this time you will find him.' So they went up to the city, and as they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place." It just so happens. Saul and Samuel end up in the same city on the very same day. A miracle of God's providence. Evidently, Samuel's circuit and Saul's servant combined to produce a divine appointment. One other point here. Samuel was headed to the high place to oversee the sacrifice. High places were elevated altars, usually associated with some kind of idol or fertility goddess. When Israel entered into the land, they were forbidden from erecting these high places or worshiping at these high places. Sacrifices were only to be offered at the tabernacle. But according to Jeremiah chapter 7 verse 12, when the ark was stolen by the Philistines, we talked about that last week, the tabernacle in Shiloh was destroyed. That's why during the time that the ark was kept in Kiriath-Jearim, there was no tabernacle to worship in. They were sort of waiting for the temple to be built. And while the tabernacle was out of order, evidently God allowed sacrifices on these high places for a time. I guess the only condition was that a Levitical priest should supervise, and this is why Samuel is going up to the high place to oversee this sacrifice. As he's going up, he intersects with Saul. Verse 15. "Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, 'Tomorrow,'" isn't that interesting? The Lord told Samuel in his ear. Has the Lord ever spoken to you and spoken something in your ear? Just whispered something to you at a critical time and a point of connection? Just whispered something in your ear. Sometimes the Lord does that. "Saying, 'Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me.'" God tells Samuel that tomorrow you'll meet a man from the land of Benjamin. And exactly 24 hours later, he bumps into a sheepless Saul. It was a God thing.
In the book of 1 Samuel, you get to meet a boy who became a man, helping guide and counsel others after him. The era of the kings of Israel began with the events of this book of the Bible. As you read along, you notice that some people followed God with all their heart. Others seemed to waver, depending on how the situation would benefit them. What is the state of your interactions with God? Do you follow Him wholeheartedly, or does it depend on if it'll help you out in the circumstances that you're in? It's definitely something to ponder as you listen and learn more about these characters in the Bible. There's always something for you to gain from those who have lived before you. Spend time praying today, asking the Lord to reveal the areas in your life that may be showing your commitment to God or lack thereof. You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio Today with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. To learn more about this ministry, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. You could even stop by and see us this weekend. The details of where we meet and when can be found once you follow the link to Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. Well, that's all we have time for today, but we'll catch up with you next time on Sandy Adams Radio.